I'm very bullish on real estate today. Like, I think, again, these demographic trends that we see, the lack of supply in multifamily, we didn't build enough over the last decade. We didn't build enough apartments. We didn't build enough houses. And that's one of the reasons I moved into this space over the last decade. It's like, we just don't have enough. So let's go into an area that there is a tremendous demand, right? Like, that's a good business to be in. And real estate is a business. We're buying businesses.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I am so excited to introduce our amazing guest for the day, Chris Larson. Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, I'm excited to be here. This is great.
Yes, I'm excited to share your story. You've got a wealth of experience in real estate investing. So everyone, today's guest, Chris Larson, is the founder and managing principal of Next Level Income. Chris has been investing in and managing real estate for over 20 years. He bought his first rental property in college at the age of 21. And from there, he's expanded into development, private lending, buying distressed debt, as well as commercial offices, and ultimately syndicating multifamily properties. We all love syndication here on this podcast. So really excited to dive into your story. Chris, why don't you start us off by telling us a little bit about how and why you got into real estate investing in the first place as a college student?
Yeah. So thank you very much for the intro. And by the way, if you're listening today, free gift for your listeners. If you're listening, you can check out my website, nextlevelincome.com. And if you put your address in at the book link, I'll send you a free copy. So everything we talk about today, it probably gets expanded upon in the book. But so I'm in college. I went to Virginia Tech for engineering, but really I went there to become a professional cyclist. So that was really my passion in high school and college. And I was racing in between my freshman and sophomore years of college. My best friend passed away. He was my training partner. He was my college roommate. He was my best friend. And I came back to school. I raced for another year and I realized I wasn't happy. And I felt like there was more to life than just riding your bike around for 20, 30 hours a week. And when you lose a friend at that age, I was 19, I thought, well, how much longer do I have to live? Is this really how I want to spend my life? I didn't have a girlfriend. I didn't really like go to parties because I wouldn't drink. I wouldn't even take Advil. Like, I was like super clean, super disciplined. And that's always been kind of one of my strengths is my discipline and my regimented activities, but it doesn't lead to a lot of fun in college. So I went back to school my junior year. I started day trading that year. So the stock market in the 90s, kind of like today, it was just crazy. And I was making like $5,000 a month day trading. I was doing a little bit better in school that year, but I was staying up. And some nights, like I'm laying there, I wouldn't sleep. So I'm laying in bed one night at 3 a.m. and I'm thinking, man, there's got to be a better way. Like, I'm 20 years old. Do I want to be 40 laying in bed at 3 a.m. and worrying about, like my trade the next day? So I continued to educate myself on investing. And by the way, I don't think trading is really investing. I think that's like an active job essentially. And I thought, all right, what are some better options out there? And I started learning about real estate. And it really kind of struck me that I could buy a property. I could negotiate the price. I could buy a property at a 10% discount. I could put 10% down and essentially double my money overnight. And I really like that control, the leverage, a lot of the different tax benefits. So that's what led me to buy my first property. And ultimately my goal then, Suja, was just to buy enough properties so I could have $10,000 of net income coming in a month before debt service. And I was like, if I get these paid off in the next 10 years, and have a job that pays me good money, I'm financially independent. So that was my first property and kind of my initial plan as I got into the space.
Yeah, very interesting. I'm curious to hear a little bit more about how kind of this experience with your best friend passing away sort of led you to, you know, this, or was, is connected to your investing path.
Yeah. So I think, you know, if you lose somebody, and there's actually some data out there. I lost my father when I was five as well. And there's data, if you lose somebody at a young age, it changes you. And there's a correlation. I think Malcolm Gladwell had this in one of his books. I remember reading about it several years ago, but there's a correlation between successful people and losing somebody at a young age. And the way I look at it, and remember, I went to school for engineering. So this is like how an engineer thinks about things, like through an equation. I'm thinking, okay, if you think you're invincible and you're going to live forever and time is infinite, then the value of each day. So if you take a day and you divide it by, you know, unlimited time, that's not a very big number. If you shrink that number, if you say, well, I'm going to live another day, I mean, that number goes up exponentially and you would live your life very, very differently if you knew you only had, say, 10 days to live. And I think what happened was when Chris passed away, I thought, all right, I don't want to have any regrets. So that meant like literally seeing a girl when I walked out of the dining hall and asking her out and being like, well, what, you know, what do I have to lose? Like, why would I give up this opportunity? Or if a friend said, hey, we should go take this adventure, you know, go on this trip. Okay, let's figure out how to make that happen. But also, how am I going to create financial independence so that I have the freedom to live life on my own terms? And that's really kind of, I don't know, like when like the exact, you know, moment happened, but that's kind of how my thought process evolved during that period.
Yeah, for sure. Tons of interesting stuff there that you just mentioned. I mean, like psychology and how we actually end up making decisions later on in life. And so very, very interesting. Well, that's cool that you, you know, and I want to just touch on this day trading part again, because, you know, there's something very important about that, especially right now when things are kind of going in the direction that they're going. I mean, you were day trading in the 90s when obviously that was pre-dot-com bubble burst. What kind of parallels are you seeing between then and now, or if any?
So I'm glad you bring that up. And one of my favorite books, I've read hundreds and hundreds of books, but I only keep a few on my bookshelf here. And one back there, it's called The Secret Life of Real Estate and Banking by, I think it's Phil Anderson. Sorry. I think George Harrison is the guy he quotes in there. I mean, it's a Beatle or something. But anyway, Phil, you can look up the book, The Secret Life of Real Estate and Banking. And it goes through real estate cycles. Now, remember, I'm a total nerd. So I love reading about like real estate history. Like this, some people may think this is like incredibly boring, but the book goes back into the 1850s about real estate cycles. Now, my parents both worked for a construction company in the early 90s. They lost their jobs. Both of them lost their jobs in the savings and loan crisis. And then I go through the 90s, I watch the market skyrocket and crash and 9/11. And then I lost my internship coming out of my MBA program. And then I'm working and I watch, you know, my properties just explode in value. And then 2008, 2009, and I'm actively involved in real estate. I'm actively involved in the stock market. And I've always been a learner. And I'm like, what is going on here? So as I researched, I came across a presentation by the gentleman who wrote the book, and he made a couple comments and he's talked about real estate cycles. And instantly I thought, yes, like that's what I've seen in my short life. Right. So I started researching it. And I think where we are right now, if you look at real estate, and I think again, real estate and the stock market are correlated. Okay. So you can disagree with me or, you know, you may be shaking your head or nodding up and down, but bear with me here. So real estate goes in 18 to 19 year cycles. And it's, if you look at demographics, it all makes sense. And that might not be an exact number, but we are in the middle. We kind of just reached the mid-cycle point where there's usually a slowdown. And you can go back and you can go to my website and you can listen to the interviews I did at the end of 2019, 2020. And I said, hey, we should start to be careful. Like, it seems like we're setting up for a correction or something going into 2020. I really got into the coronavirus outbreak when it was in China, because I'm like, this may be a catalyst, right? So I'm looking at this. I actually sold everything late 2019 because I thought this is going to get out of hand. And again, I didn't have a crystal ball, but I'm like, something's crazy. And we kind of shifted our focus on that. So what typically happens after this mid-cycle slowdown is you have this really sharp uptick in the stock market and also the property market. And this is kind of the last half of the cycle. It is a great time to make a ton of money. It's the reason we were talking before the show. We are working on a residential development right now. There's a housing shortage. People are forming homes. Interest rates are low. But I think we need to be careful as we get 3 to 5 years out of what is most likely going to be another slowdown or another potential market crash. So I can talk about some of the things I'm doing right now, but I think, you know, the stock market parallels this because there's so much money coming in. There's so much liquidity coming in. There's so much value from land and property, and one feeds the other, certainly.
For sure. Yeah, very interesting. And so just to take that back to the last cycle. So how would you characterize or describe the slope, the mid-cycle slowdown previous to this one?
Yeah. So we all remember 9/11, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting because people can say, oh, that's because 9/11. Oh, that's because of the coronavirus. Oh, well, the thing is, these things happen all the time. Like Evergrande is going down in China. You know, there's this big, you know, collapse with this company. And is this going to take down the world economy? I don't know. But what happens is a lot of times, you know, these events are correlated and we think they're causative, right? So, you know, we had a slowdown last year. I thought the economy would just tank, but exploded coming out of 2020, right? I mean, the government intervenes and does this and policy. Again, we're hearing the same things. Think about this. What did you hear in 2004, 3, 2, up to 2005? Oh, housing's too expensive. We need to relax lending standards. We need to allow people to buy more homes. Are we hearing anything like that again? Are we hearing these things in the spending packages and that? Yeah, we're hearing the same things. And you'd think we'd learn the lessons, but they repeat themselves over and over and over again.
For sure. Yeah. And there's always, I guess, like slight differences. You know, I mean, I was really young when 9/11 happened, so I wasn't so privy to like the what happened in the economy, just like in my daily life. Yeah. I mean, and of course there was what some people I hear are saying is there was a significant difference in that time because of the lending practices, right? Yes. We're lowering interest rates right now as we were back then, but also back then there was, you know, the subprime mortgage crisis and like, you know, stated income loans, which we don't have that issue right now. But I mean, I think that the general point of like these 20-year cycles is very, very important and relevant and something that I've been hearing talked about a lot recently. So
I'll agree with you on that. Yeah. And I think, yeah, history is not like, it doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. You've heard that saying, right?
Yes.
But I think something we need to overlay on this is if you look back in the 80s and 90s, what generation were buying homes back then? Like what was really fueling the market? The baby boomers, right? Biggest generation in history, except for the millennials. The millennials, right? Now, they're the ones forming homes right now. Gen X, my generation, was responsible, you know, for the housing market. And we just weren't, you know, we weren't buying as many homes. So you do have these demographic waves. And I outline the demographic waves in my book that you have to overlay over these cycles. And I think that the last crash, you know, in the upcoming, you know, whatever the upcoming downturn holds, it's going to be different because again, we have different laws in place now, different regulations, and also different demographic trends. And this, whether you agree with it or not, the immigrants flooding across the border, immigrants rent to the tune of 75, you know, maybe even as high as 80%. So, I mean, you have a lot of different things going on right now. So it's certainly different than it was, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years.
You mean
ago.
In terms of a tightening rental market?
Oh, we are way undersupplied.
Yeah, for sure. When you say 70 to 80%, are you saying 75 to 80% of immigrants rent?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Versus own. Yeah. So different demographic segments, you know, have different rental and ownership rates and, you know, immigrants, which it makes sense. They're starting from, you know, scratch a lot of times. So they're going to rent for a longer period than somebody that's been in this country and, you know, has been more established, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, I'm curious as to, you know, you alluded to this earlier, how you are kind of preparing for or viewing the next 3, 5, 7, 10 years in terms of your investments. I mean, clearly you're doing a development right now, which maybe you can just talk about briefly. And then what are you doing to prepare and kind of plan for?
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-cap.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Yeah. So first off, I'm very bullish on real estate today. Like, I think, again, these demographic trends that we see, the lack of supply in multifamily, we didn't build enough over the last decade. We didn't build enough apartments. We didn't build enough houses. And that's one of the reasons I moved into this space over the last decade. It's like, we just don't have enough. So let's go into an area that there is a tremendous demand, right? Like, that's a good business to be in. And real estate is a business. We're buying businesses. So I think that's great. We also, I moved to Asheville, and I always tell people I put my money where my mouth is. I'm super logical, so I always have a reason for stuff. I might be wrong, and I'd love people to call me out. But we moved to Asheville almost 14 years ago. And the reason was, you have this trend of technology, the ability to live wherever you want. And Asheville was one of the areas that I identified and said, you know what, people are going to move here in greater numbers because it's got a great quality of life. It's got tons of restaurants and culture. And it's in a state, North Carolina, that has a good fiscal situation that it's in. I'm like, this is going to be a good place to move. We were living outside of DC at the time. Well, those trends have continued, but COVID-19 2020 has accelerated those trends. So, you know, baby boomers are downsizing, millennials are forming homes, and they would rather live in an area like this than live in, you know, like Chicago, for instance, or New York City, because they want to live in a little bit more affordable, you know, area with better quality of life. Well, there's not enough homes around here. So, you know, if we can supply a product, a house that has, you know, we focus on kind of like sustainable development. So, for instance, this piece of property, we do 29 lots. We're only doing 15 bigger lots, more trees, you know, really, really nice features and designs. We feel like that's a good area to be in. I think that's bolstered by the demographic trends.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I mean, I'm curious also about that. So when you are having bigger lots, is that for environmental reasons, or is it because what you think the market will desire?
Yeah, I think it's a balance. I mean, John Mackey, who founded Whole Foods, has a great term called conscious capitalism. And look, I'm an environmentalist. I'm also a capitalist. So if we make a little bit less money because we're providing, you know, something that's more in line with our values, that's something that we're capable of doing with doing this. Whereas if we buy an apartment building, it's a little bit of a different situation. You know, it's a more of an economic, totally financially driven model where we're providing the products, the services, the amenities within that community that the renters desire. This is a little bit more art than science sometimes when it comes to building these communities. And let me add, there was one thing you said, what else are you doing to prepare? I am accumulating cash as well over the next, you know, 3 to 5 years, because a little bit more than I would have been over the last 5 years to prepare for, you know, hopefully some upcoming opportunities.
Okay. Yes. So, and just so I am clear on that. So like, in terms of understanding where we are in the market cycle, we're about mid cycle. So we've still got potentially up to 10 years, you know.
That's a really good point you made. So if you think about the cycle being, let's call it 19 years. Okay. And, you know, if the last cycle started around 2012 and we're coming out of this, the cycle starts, you have the mid-cycle slowdown. So about halfway through in 2019, 2020, the end of the cycle is typically about 4 years. And that's a down market for 4 years. So I would say we are entering, you have the second half, but we're probably about 8 years out from the start of the next cycle, which in my estimate would give us, like I mentioned, I keep saying 3 to 5 years. That's where I get that figure. I think the next 3 to 5 years when I would start to get a little nervous again.
Totally. Yes. And I mean, I have heard similar timeframes, like somewhere around 2025, 2026, with a slightly different, you know, economic cycle picture, but, you know, generally the same idea. So
I think that's a good estimate. Personally.
Yeah, for sure.
So might be wrong. Don't have a crystal ball. So
none of us have a crystal ball, but we have to figure out how to make decisions and move forward. You know what I mean? Like, we have to somehow come up with an analysis and try to act conservatively within that analysis but also be aggressive enough to like still do business and make things happen and build homes for people. You know, I was just curious though, just when you think about making a bigger lot size, are you doing that to kind of lower the environmental footprint or to create a better quality of life for the families that are there?
I think both. I think you can have, you know, like you may make less money if you have more lots, you may make less money, right? So I think your profitability per lot will go up when you have those larger lots, but your gross profit is going to go down most likely because you don't have as many lots to sell. So we're targeting a market that's a little bit different than just the, you know, just slam as many houses in. So a little bit of a higher end market. So we should get, you know, a little bit of higher dollar per square foot and also have a product that's, you know, that we can be a little bit broader of at the end.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Okay. So what are some of the ways, like over the last, you know, 20 years or so that you've been investing in real estate, that what are some things that have really helped you supercharge your investing or really take it to the next level?
Yeah. Which I love when you say next level. So thank you. But I think the biggest thing is mentors, coaches. So whenever I've sought out education, you know, spent say $15,000 on a mastermind, you know, I'm trying to, you know, $15,000, $20,000 on a coach, that money has come back as a multiple. So if you're listening, no matter what your strategy is, no matter what you want to do, if you can find a mentor, if you can find a coach, if you can find education, I mean, that is the best investment you can make. So I've always been a learner. I'm always like trying to figure out, you know, what kind of the next trends are, you know, what are the next things, but I always try to find somebody who can help me on that journey and shortcut that path. And that's really my goal with Next Level Income. We started it as an education platform to help investors, to help people reach their next level, but learn from the mistakes, you know, take my path and don't take 15 years to figure it out. You figure out in 15 months and then get going on your own path.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that we hear this over and over again, at least in this space, that, you know, actually investing in yourself and finding the right group of people to learn from and grow with, and is just absolutely critical to supercharging success. So really couldn't agree more on that. And it's just, but it's one thing to know that, and it's another thing to actually take the action and do it. Right. So,
yeah. And it's scary if you're thinking like, oh my gosh, I'm going to hire this person to help me do this, and you haven't actually achieved anything yet. It's scary. You know, it is scary to do that, but you know, you have to take that first step. You gotta do that. So it's a lot easier if somebody's holding your hand along the way, though.
Yeah, totally. It is scary. And I think ultimately though, if you can feel like your commitment to yourself, you know, that you're committed to following this through and making it happen, then, you know, it doesn't matter if it's like not exactly the right fit, because, you know, there's going to be other opportunities to learn from other people along the way. And, you know, you got to use your gut instinct too, right? Like, is this a good fit for me?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's a terrific point. Like it's got to, you know, like maybe this development doesn't work for you. Short-term rentals are a great option, as we were talking about before the show, work for a lot of people. Multifamily, I love, but you know, some people like to be more or less involved and be true to yourself. I think that's a great, great point.
Yeah, for sure. So you've done a lot of different types of real estate investing, and you know, currently you're doing multifamily syndications along with some other things, but where do you place the different types of real estate investing in terms of like why you've moved towards syndications, et cetera?
Yeah. So if I had to do one thing, it would be the multifamily side. That's probably 75% of our portfolio. I love the demographic trends. I love the scalability. I think it's a very stable part in the market, you know, supported by housing. The development side, these smaller projects, they're more for fun. They're almost like a hobby at this point. And it allows me to be a little bit more creative and a little less, you know, analytical, which I'm just prone to being. So I like to do that. But again, I think, you know, if you're getting started, if you're not interested in managing, you know, your own tenants and dealing with the calls and the headaches, and believe me, I've done all that a lot. You know, it's great to be involved in a syndication. You say, hey, I want to be involved in multifamily or self-storage or hotels, or you pick a market. And the neat thing is you can invest and also get an education, because you're working with hopefully a high quality operator that you can learn from, see what they do. You can follow along. You can read through all the financials and figure that stuff out. And then you can decide, hey, is this something, you know, that I want to be, you know, want to be a bigger part of? You can partner with people. So if you're an investor just getting started, one of my coaching clients, he's in California, and he needed, I think it was around $500,000 to buy a property. And he found a partner that wanted to learn. And my coaching client had the knowledge and the experience, but this person just happened to have a lot of cash. So they partner together. So don't go it alone. You know, figure out, you know, what your strategy is, find a good operator that you can invest with, or find a partner that you can work with that hopefully brings something that you don't have, and then move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much there that you just went over. And I like how you talked about development kind of being an opportunity for you to flex your creative muscles. I guess I also have an interest in doing development, but it's, you know, from a risk profile, it's not exactly where I want to be putting, you know, the bulk of my efforts and energy. But I like that it's kind of like a hobby for you. I feel like that's probably the route that I'm going to take eventually at some point. It's like, okay, I'll do development on the side. But like most of the stuff that I'm going to do is like recession resilient and a little bit more, you know, you can kind of focus on the analytics a little bit more. Speaking of which, you have an engineering background, right? And how has that influenced your, I mean, I love talking to engineers because a lot of times engineers are very analytical when it comes to real estate investing. And how's it been for you?
Yeah. So I think it's helped out a lot. And I always joke, I say like my engineering advisor pulled me aside and said, hey, Chris, like you're not smart enough to be an engineer and you have too much personality. So you're going to have to figure out something else to do. So I ended up in sales for like two decades. But I got to work in the medical device industry. So I got to apply my understanding of these sorts of things. And by the way, I passed the professional engineering exam. So people are like, see, you are an engineer. I barely passed it, but I passed it. So the thing is, I love my education. It's something I wouldn't have done on my own. All this other stuff I've done, business school, economics, financial, like I do that in my spare time. Engineering, you had to like basically, you know, drag me to thermodynamics class, for instance. But engineering is about having a set of assumptions and then solving a problem. And I have this conversation so many times because people don't even understand the process of solving a problem. So like COVID-19, for instance, so many people have the assumptions wrong. And you know, it doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter, you know, whether you want to get a vaccine or not get a vaccine. But if your assumptions are incorrect, you can't solve the problem properly. And the problem today is that the news filters things. You know, you read this, it tells you one thing. You watch that, it tells you something else. You've got to drill down and figure out what the assumptions are. So for me, being able to look at something like demographics that support the multifamily space, like demographics are big and slow moving, right? And we talked about like, you know, generations. We know how generations are going to act at certain ages. We know that, you know, if you're 30 or 35 years old, you're probably going to want to buy your first house because you probably just got married and you're probably either having a kid or going to have a kid. Like that's pretty baked in, you know, into most people's behavior. You know, when you're in your 60s, you're probably looking to retire. You know, when you're in your early 40s and you have money and you're going through a midlife crisis, you're probably more likely to buy like a sports car or something, right? Or buy a bigger house in your 40s because your kids are older. Like we just behave in these sorts of things. So those are the kind of assumptions and that's the kind of data I look for. So when I build out my investing model, I can say, all right, are these assumptions pretty good? Like if my assumptions are better than 50-50 most of the time, I'm going to win most of the time, right? So that's assuming I know how to solve the problem. So I think if you're looking at it from an engineering perspective, yeah, get really good at solving problems, but then challenge your assumptions, figure out what the data is that you can, you know, base really good assumptions on, but then keep learning and don't assume that those assumptions, that's a terrible statement, but don't assume that data won't change because that's where people get into trouble. They think, hey, the market is never going to change. It's going to go in one direction. No, things will change, right? So we have to constantly be evaluating, you know, solving for that.
For sure. So you mentioned demographic trends, which is obviously super important. Are there other metrics or assumptions that you would point to as being super important for evaluating investments?
Ooh, yeah. So this could, let's pick an example.
Okay.
Sure. So let's use short-term rentals. Okay. So this is something that we've been talking about. So, okay. You have demographic trends that support like the multifamily market, but then you also have behavioral trends and changes. You know, I mentioned like people moving to areas like Asheville. Short-term rentals are on fire right now. Why is that? There are people that will never stay in a hotel ever again, okay, because of the pandemic. They want to be in an area where they're not around big masses of people. That's probably a prudent decision if you want to not be exposed to pathogens that are in the air. But also millennials behave differently. And Susie, you seem a little bit younger than me, so I'm going to say maybe you're in that category. I have people that come and stay in our short-term rentals. They've never stayed in a hotel. I mean, I stayed in hotels, you know, 70, 80 nights a year. So for me, it's bizarre that in some ways, you know, they've never rented a hotel. They've only stayed in Airbnbs. Yeah. So you also have to look at, you know, you have to look at demographics, but then you also have to look at generational trends and figure that out. And I think it's really fascinating to look at like Gen Z that's coming up. If you listen to my podcast, I had a young lady by the name of Hannah on, and she's a Gen Z consultant. She's 23 years old and she's consulting companies on how to hire because she understands that. So it's pretty cool if you can understand the way people behave in mass, and you can make some really, really good choices and investing decisions based upon that.
For sure. Awesome stuff. Well, thank you so much, Chris, for sharing so much, you know, interesting stuff on like macroeconomic trends and, you know, how to really be successful in this space. Tons of awesome value. Please, will you share with the audience how they can learn more about you and anything else you want to share?
Yeah, absolutely. If you want to check out any of the podcasts I mentioned, if you want to get a free copy of my book, nextlevelincome.com. We have a ton of free resources up there. And again, you can get a copy of the book. If you put your address in, I'll even send you a copy.
Awesome. All right, Chris. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. We'll see you next time.
It's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.